You're listening to an SBS News podcast.
Australia will recognise the state of Palestine.
Netanyahu has gone way too far. I think he has lost the plot.
If the FBI wants me, I'm here.
President Trump is determined to try and end this war and stop the killing.
Because that's what I do. I make deals.
Welcome back to another episode of World News Weekly. I'm Claudia Fahart in Bangkok.
And I'm Ben Lewis in London.
Hello, Ben. Lots happening as we're recording this week. Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin are about to meet face-to-face for the first time in 6 years.
Yes, all eyes are on Alaska, where President Trump is going to gaze into Putin's eyes and apparently know if the war could be ended within the first 2 minutes of conversation. Right now, though, he's busy taking control of Washington, D.C. We'll get into that soon, as well as what Australia's recognition of Palestinian statehood might mean for the war in Gaza.
We're also going to have correspondent Prula Wan on the show this week for a look at the Haitian gang leader who now has a multi-million dollar bounty on his head. Plus, if you need a little confidence boost, stick around till the end for the story of what could possibly be the world's worst assassin.
Big thing, we're going to Russia, that's going to be a big deal. And it's embarrassing for me to be up here. You know, I'm going to see Putin, I'm going to Russia.
That was Donald Trump there, getting a little confused, perhaps, as to where he is meeting Vladimir Putin. The two presidents will be sitting down to chat one-on-one at an American airbase just outside Anchorage. The White House has been talking down the prospects of a breakthrough after Trump's bold declarations, now saying it's a listening opportunity for Trump, while Kyiv and its European allies are concerned about what the US president might agree to. So, Ben, first of all, look into that crystal ball I know you keep there in London. What's likely to come out of this meeting, do you think?
I think a good result on Ukraine's part would be a second meeting where Volodymyr Zelensky gets invited. It could be a trilateral meeting somewhere where the meaty issues can actually be discussed and there's a third party in the room. So it's not just Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin sitting there without any advisers. Essentially, President Putin has won by just getting this meeting on US soil. Now, I think he'll probably say to Donald Trump, look, we're winning on the battlefield at the moment, but we're prepared to stop if Ukraine hands over all of the four regions we claim as our own. Now, of course, that's something Ukraine cannot accept. Zelensky can't agree because it would require changes to the Ukrainian constitution, and that's something that lawmakers simply wouldn't support. I think the other thing President Putin will try to do is convince Trump that it's actually Zelensky holding up the peace process, and he'll suggest that cutting off the flow of weapons to Kyiv will end the war quicker. And just having this meeting delays talk of secondary sanctions. Remember, Donald Trump had sent that 50, then 10-day deadline, and in the end, he put some secondary sanctions or secondary tariffs in place on India, but didn't follow through with anything else. The big question is, does Donald Trump buy what Putin is selling? And remember, he has in the past. Think about that time they met in Finland, where Trump had that extraordinary press conference where he said he trusted Putin over his own intelligence community. And while Trump has already suggested land swaps between Ukraine and Russia, it's really not clear what Russia would be expected to give up. Now, Donald Trump apparently told European leaders that his priority for this meeting is to get a ceasefire out of it. That seems unlikely. Of course, anything is possible. It wouldn't surprise me too if Putin tries to focus on areas where the US and Russia can work together. So energy cooperation, maybe Arctic drilling, appeal to Trump's long-held desire to reset the relationship with Moscow.
Yeah, in the past, we've seen US presidents take a very, very different approach when meeting with the Russian leaders. I mean, you think of Joe Biden's combative meeting with Putin back in 2021, or that famous photo of Barack Obama staring him down after the invasion of Crimea. Yet at this meeting, President Trump seems to be simply wanting an informal chat. How do you think the Kremlin's going to be feeling about this?
Look, they must be delighted. It's a huge propaganda opportunity back in Russia, and Putin hasn't had to do anything to get this meeting. There's been no ceasefire, no withdrawal from Ukrainian territory. From what we understand, he simply asked for a meeting and it's happened. It is important for him domestically to be seen standing side by side with the leader of the most powerful country on earth. It makes Putin out to be more powerful, more important than he actually is. It is a huge propaganda opportunity, and he has also cut out the involvement, for now at least, of Europe and Ukraine, which is something he has made very clear that he wants.
Yeah, speaking of European leaders, they seem nervous, to put it mildly, as does the Ukrainian president, about all of this.
Yeah, so Germany's chancellor organised what was sort of a pre-game session on Wednesday for European leaders, Zelensky, to drill into Trump the idea that deals can't be done without Ukraine and Europe in the room. Now, maybe that worked, because we heard from Keir Starmer, Emmanuel Macron, Friedrich Merz afterwards. They all sounded a little bit more relaxed about things, thinking that Trump is on the same page, that territory swaps can't be negotiated without Ukraine's presence, that a ceasefire was the main priority. The issue with Donald Trump, of course, is that he's unpredictable, and Vladimir Putin has spent decades running rings around some of the world's most experienced leaders and diplomats. For Zelensky, this is, of course, very difficult. He needs the support of Trump so the American weapons keep flowing. So he doesn't want to be too publicly critical of him, and he also doesn't want Ukraine to be fully cut out of this process. Claudia, one thing to keep an eye out on. We know this meeting is happening in Alaska, in Anchorage. Donald Trump the other day at the White House, we heard accidentally saying he's going to be going to Russia. It would not surprise me at all if they hop on a helicopter after the meeting in Anchorage and fly the few kilometres across the border into Russia so that Trump can say, I've been to Russia. I'm the first president in how long to go to Russia. He did a similar thing in North Korea. He loves that sort of dramatic showman moment. Would not surprise me if he ends up in Russia, even if it's just a little footstep across the border.
Yeah, he might have been saying the quiet part out loud there.
A two-state solution is humanity's best hope to break the cycle of violence and to bring an end to the conflict, suffering and starvation.
No, it won't bring peace. It'll bring war. To have European countries and Australia march into that rabbit hole, just like that, fall right into it and buy this canard.
Some strong words there from the Israeli Prime Minister after Anthony Albanese announced Australia would join France, Canada and the UK in recognising Palestinian statehood at the UN General Assembly next month. It comes with some conditions. Hamas would be allowed no part in a future Palestinian state. That state would need to be totally demilitarised, and the Palestinian Authority would need to undergo substantial reform, all of which Anthony Albanese says the Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas has already agreed to. So, Ben, we've been talking about this global push towards Palestinian recognition on the pod for weeks now. Australia has taken the plunge.
Yeah, and it is no surprise. That is the way that the world seems to be heading at the moment. It's interesting looking at those conditions that we heard Penny Wong and Anthony Albanese talking about. They say they've received assurances from the Palestinian Authority. It's quite similar to the approach that Canada took. The Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney said, we will recognise an independent Palestinian state. However, we need the Palestinian Authority to commit to reforms and to announce that free and fair elections will be held within the next 12 months. You look at the way the UK did it, again, very different. They're essentially using Palestinian recognition as a threat. They're saying to Israel, we will do this at the UN General Assembly in September unless you reach a ceasefire deal, increase the amount of aid going into the Gaza Strip and stop the expansion of settlements in the West Bank. So all big countries, all doing it in a slightly different way. And I keep thinking back to British Prime Minister Keir Starmer saying, this is a lever you only get to pull once. You need to make it count. Now, you'll hear a lot of people say that this is purely a symbolic move. In some ways it is. In others, it does have practical ramifications, particularly regarding international law. The Israeli government, of course, furious about all of this, saying that it only rewards Hamas. The reaction of the United States has been interesting. Donald Trump, every time another leader has said, you know, my country is going to recognise an independent Palestinian state, has said, look, we disagree with it. Same line about rewarding Hamas. But at the end of the day, he goes, it's their countries. They can do what they want. So there hasn't really been a huge amount of blowback from Israel's strongest ally.
Yeah, and as for the Palestinian community in Australia and their supporters, they've welcomed this. They're largely happy about it. But they are asking the question, how is this move going to help alleviate the suffering in Gaza that's happening right now. They're asking, where are the practical measures from Canberra as well, whether it's, you know, putting more sanctions on the Israeli government rather than just the couple of far-right ministers they've sanctioned so far, or whether it's, you know, reassessing Australia's role in contributing to the F-35 supply chain. Our Defence Minister, Richard Marles, says Australia doesn't sell weapons to Israel, but we do sell weapons parts to Israel. We still have 35 defence export permits still valid to Israel. The other thing that I want to mention is recognising statehood and realising statehood are two completely different things. In order for the second one to happen, for a Palestinian state to actually be established, there are huge issues that are going to have to be resolved first. I mean, the status of East Jerusalem, which has been annexed and under Israel's control for decades, the settlements in the West Bank that Palestinians say are probably the single greatest barrier to creating statehood, because they come with 700,000 people who would need to be moved out of that territory in order for it to become the bulk of a future Palestinian state. Israel has been clear it's not going to engage on any of these issues under international pressure. There's also a growing portion of Palestinian society, because of those barriers, that have kind of abandoned the concept of a two-state solution altogether. They just don't believe it's actually practical anymore, as much as they'd like to see it realized, and are instead sort of focusing perhaps a little bit more realistically on the idea of one state where they can enjoy equal rights.
And as the diplomacy was picking up this week, so were Israel's plans for the next phase of the war. After huge amounts of pressure from his own military, Benjamin Netanyahu seemed to stop short of ordering the full reoccupation of the Strip, but he did order a military takeover of Gaza City, which before the war was home to about a third of the Strip's population. His plan was met with almost universal opposition overseas, bar the US, but Netanyahu says the city is one of Hamas's last strongholds and insists this is the best way to end the war.
Netanyahu's now denying that the plan is to reoccupy the Gaza Strip after that huge amount of backlash we talked about last week in response to reports that that's where he was going. But if you look at the details that came out of this Israeli Security Cabinet meeting, they released a five-point plan for ending the war. One of the points was that the war won't end until Israel takes security control of the entire Gaza Strip, which suggests they're going to have some sort of ongoing permanent presence there, as they have in the West Bank. That's effectively describing an occupation, which is just exercising control over a territory that's not your own. So they might not be using the language, but it does seem to be where that's headed. The other thing is this: Israel is already in control of about 75% of the Gaza Strip. It now wants to add Gaza City, and it's suggesting that some of the remaining refugee camps in the central part of the Strip that aren't currently under its control are going to come next.
And if this is all a ploy to increase pressure on Hamas to agree to a deal, so far it does not seem to have worked. Now, this operation might not begin for a little while yet. There are around 1 million people currently sheltering in and around Gaza City. This plan would involve displacing all of them to the south of the Strip once again. There are reports coming out of Israel that the deadline to leave is going to be October 7, so about 2 months from now. And it's at that point the IDF would launch its new ground operation to take control of the city before moving to the remaining parts of central Gaza. So the indication is that this war still has many months ahead of it, at the very least.
In the meantime, though, we've already started to see Israel's airstrikes on Gaza City intensify. We want to talk about one incident in particular that happened earlier this week that killed four Al Jazeera journalists, including correspondent Anas Al-Sharif, who has been one of the most prominent Arabic-speaking reporters documenting this conflict since the outset. This was a targeted attack, Israel accusing Sharif of being the head of a Hamas cell, which Al Jazeera staunchly denies.
Yeah, and in the months leading up to his death, Al-Sharif had actually posted some critical messages of Hamas on social media. There is a lot of discussion and debate about his past, but obviously the targeting of journalists in a conflict is considered a war crime. Put Al-Sharif aside, there were a number of other journalists who were killed in that airstrike, and Israel provided no justification, to use their word, for their deaths. This has been an incredibly deadly conflict for journalists. The Committee to Protect Journalists says 184 have been killed since the war started, and we are relying on Palestinian journalists to let us know what is going on there. All the pictures you see on SBS World News every night, they are shot by Palestinian journalists. Foreign media have not been allowed in since the start of the conflict. And once again, we and pretty much every other major news organisation in the Western world are calling for access to the Gaza Strip to be able to independently document what's happening there.
So far, the only journalists that have been allowed in have been accompanied by the IDF with what they've been allowed to see, who they've been allowed to engage with, very tightly controlled. So, as you say, if not for those journalists on the ground covering this every day, we would not be able to bring these stories every night.
He is a notorious gang leader from Haiti, who has orchestrated and committed various acts of violence against Haitians in Haiti.
If the FBI wants me, I'm here. I'm willing to collaborate with them on one condition. There can be no lies told.
That was Jimmy Chirizier, better known as Barbecue, responding to criminal charges that have been slapped on him by the United States for violating US sanctions. Washington is also offering a bounty of $5 million for information leading to his arrest. Chirizier fronts the Gang Alliance, which controls the vast majority of Haiti's capital, Port-au-Prince.
For more on this story, I've been chatting to correspondent Prue Lawan, who has been doing some excellent reporting out of Haiti over the past couple of years. Prue, what's going on here? What's this all about?
Claudia, it's fascinating for two reasons, what's going on in terms of Jimmy Chirizier. Fascinating because Haiti and Chirizier are themselves hyper interesting, but also what it indicates US policy may be in the future toward other bad actors or perceived bad actors, not only in the Western Hemisphere, but globally. So the background to this is that Chirizier, notorious gang leader of Haiti, who is one of the gang leaders of an alliance called Vive Ensemble, which he created, he allegedly took part in a notorious massacre in 2018 in La Saline in Port-au-Prince. As a consequence of that, the US Treasury imposes sanctions upon him in 2020. And it can do that because the United States in 2016 passes what's called the Global Magnitsky Human Rights Accountability Act. And that can be used by the US president to impose economic sanctions upon any foreigner who has engaged in human rights violations. So think about that. That could be used on any continent. And it happens to have been used against Chirizier. And the one indictment in this charge that was announced this week is that Chirizier and another Haitian, who's now naturalized US citizen, tried to get around those sanctions. And so we had the extraordinary scene of a person from the Department of Justice, a new Trump appointee, from the FBI and the State Department announcing a $5 million US reward yesterday for information that leads to the arrest or conviction of Chirizier. And Claudia, the funny thing about this is we all know where he is. He lives about a 15-minute motorbike ride from downtown Port-au-Prince. I hopped on a motorbike a few months ago, went to his compound. It was the second time I've been there. We all know where he is. So is this all window dressing or will something else happen? He is a notorious figure. The State Department says one reason for doing this is that his activity could lead to, wait for it, illegal immigration washing up on the shores of the United States. What is the one policy that the Trump administration is built on? It's immigration. In addition to that, Chirizier's organization, Vive Ensemble, just to repeat, he is one of several leaders, was classified as a foreign terrorist organization by the Trump administration in May of this year. So does this all lead to something? Well, we know who he is. What's going to happen next? And that raises questions about a whole bunch of other bad actors all around the Western Hemisphere, and I think we can imagine other places as well.
Prue, you obviously have a pretty rare insight into this story, having met the man not once but twice. I'm curious to ask you, what's he like? And given that so many journalists like yourself do know where he is, do you think this is going to lead to his capture?
He said, Claudia, in a social media post that he is willing to, quote, collaborate as long as there are no lies. Well, I think the FBI is well past collaborating. This is a serious indictment, and it just boggles the mind if he were to be taken and flown into the United States. But ahead of that, to answer your question, what's he like? Cherezier styles himself as the leader of an armed group. Those are his words. Mm. He speaks English, right? So he rejects the idea that he's a gang leader, that he's a murderer, and he chooses to speak English for his message being one of, this is a country that's been ripped off, and he likes to think of himself as perhaps almost a Robin Hood figure, okay?
Mm.
The problem with that is that in the process of Vivant Somme trying to, in his words, destroy everything, even in the last 3 months, another 1,500 people were killed, murdered by the gangs. In a country of 11.7 million people, half of them don't know where they're going to get a meal. You have 1.3 million people who have fled their homes. And Claudia, what that looks like, so 90% of the capital is controlled by Vivant Somme. And you have people who have fled multiple times, and they're not just fleeing men with guns. They are fleeing rape. They're fleeing kidnapping. It is horrendous. And then Cherezier says to me on both occasions that I've met him, on Sundays, he goes to the beach. Now, it's a beautiful island. You can see the ocean. Why does no one else go to the beach? Because you have to pass through gang territory. There's one thing that I now recall that he said to me in 2023, which is, I said to him, where do you get the money from? It's always a case of follow the money. And because guns cost a lot of money, right? They don't grow on trees. They don't manufacture any in Haiti. And he said to me, and I have it on tape, people from the diaspora send money to me. Now, he said they were sending money to him because they want him to be in power so that he looks after the area. But even back then in 2023, he acknowledged that the diaspora was sending him money. In the press conference, the Department of Justice officials said the Department of Justice will be coming after any Americans who send him money. So we'll see where that goes. But in answer to the question, what's Cherezier like? He is well-spoken. He has an idea that he's doing this for the masses, and I haven't met a single person, an ordinary civilian, who agrees with him.
Fascinating story. We'll be sure to keep an eye on where it goes. But Prue, thank you so much for joining us on the pod today.
My pleasure, Claudia. Hope to do it again.
And if you're keen to see Prue's reporting in Haiti and those pretty unique interactions she's had with barbecue over the past couple of years, you can find those on SBS On Demand and on our YouTube channel as well.
And I said, you tell them, you spit and we hit, and they can hit real hard. It's a disgusting thing. I've watched that for years, for three, four years. I've watched them. The police are standing, and they're told, don't do anything under any search of this, and you can see they want to get at it. And they're standing there, and people are spitting in their face, and they're not allowed to do anything. But now they are allowed to do whatever the hell they want.
That was Donald Trump, of course, announcing he is taking over the police department in Washington, D.C. and deploying 800 National Guard to the Capitol, declaring he needs to, quote, rescue the city from a wave of lawlessness, despite violent crime having dropped in the last year.
It's the second time this year he's unilaterally deployed troops in a Democrat-controlled city after National Guard troops were sent to Los Angeles in June following riots. Critics say it's federal overreach, trying to fix a problem that doesn't exist for political gain and to avoid talking about the Epstein scandal. Trump says it's overdue, though, and has signaled other big American cities, all Democrat ones, of course, including Chicago and Baltimore, could be next. Ben, you've spent a fair bit of time in DC around elections. Is the military needed to restore law and order, do you reckon?
First of all, Claudia, I love DC. If you ever get the chance to go, wonderful, cool museums, nice restaurants, good bars. Anyway, wonderful city. But like all big American cities, it has some very nice areas and some shadier ones on the outskirts. In 2023, violent crime, including murder, did soar. However, 2024 has been a big success story for the city's police force. Violent crime was down 35%, and it's down an additional 26% so far this year. Now, the mayor of DC is a Democrat, Muriel Bowser, and she's not normally one to shy away from a fight with Trump. You might remember she painted Black Lives Matter in big letters in front of the White House during his previous term. Interestingly, she's taking a diplomatic tone here. She's rejecting the president's claims of widespread violence while saying she is prepared to work with the federal government. You'd suspect she's simply hoping that the troops will come, they'll walk around the streets for a bit, take a few selfies with tourists, and then leave, similar to what we saw happen in Los Angeles early this year.
Yeah, as you say, it's happened before, but I guess sending troops to the Capitol has a special kind of symbolism. I mean, it's a display of power, really, particularly in a district that has voted overwhelmingly against Donald Trump at all three elections he's run in. In the case of this last one, he got less than 7% of the vote to Kamala Harris's 92%. So no questions as to how the people of DC would likely be feeling about this. The Democrats say it's a soft launch of authoritarianism, and his critics are calling it his biggest attempt at distraction yet, because if you look at what's happening in the background, the Epstein saga is just dealing more and more blows. His MAGA base are still calling out for the Epstein files that he originally promised to release. Trump tried to appease them with some different files, but that didn't really work out. This week, the courts rejected his attempt to unseal records from the grand jury that indicted Ghislaine Maxwell, not because they were too sensitive, but because it would set a dangerous precedent, and they offered no new information. In the judge's words, the entire premise that the Maxwell grand jury materials would bring to light meaningful new information about Epstein and Maxwell's crimes or the government's investigation into them is demonstrably false. Ben, we know just a few days before this DC announcement, we had reports that top Trump officials were meeting at the White House to discuss their strategy on how to deal with the fallout of the Epstein scandal going forward. Some are now speculating this might be part of what they came up with.
This is a slight segue here, but before we end this topic, can I just give a plug? The best barbecue in Washington, D.C. is at a joint. It's called Federalist Pig. Isn't that a great name for a barbecue restaurant in Washington, D.C.? Anyway, I don't get anything from them. They do amazing ribs. Federalist Pig.
If you're listening to this, Federalist Pig, we'll send you our address for some samples. Okay, to some other news now, too big to ignore, so let's do a quick whip around the globe. First to China. The man once tipped to be China's next foreign minister has disappeared from public view as President Xi continues his so-called purge of officials. Liu Zhenqiao, who occupied a variety of key roles in the Communist Party, had been expected to replace the previous foreign minister, Qin Gang, who fell from favour in 2023 when he was revealed to have had an affair that produced a child.
That'll do it. Instead, the 61-year-old's promotion was never announced, even though he continued to make important foreign visits as head of international relations for the party. And according to widespread rumours on the internet, he was met off his plane on his return from a visit to Singapore, South Africa and Algeria late last month and led away. His house was also later searched, according to Reuters. Other senior officials in the CCP must surely be wondering if they could be next.
A couple of weeks ago, we touched on the resurgence of IS in Africa after a deadly church attack in the Democratic Republic of the Congo was linked to the militant group. And now the United Nations says nearly 60,000 people have fled Mozambique's northern Cabo Delgado province in just 2 weeks amid a years-long rebellion by a group known locally as Al-Shabaab, which has connections to IS. They don't have connections, though, to the Al-Shabaab in Somalia.
More than 6,100 people have been killed since the beginning of the insurrection. Human Rights Watch reports the armed group has ramped up their abductions of children and is using them as fighters or for labour or marriage. UN experts say the threat from IS and Al-Qaeda extremists and their affiliates is most intense in unstable parts of Africa, And risks are also growing in Syria, which both groups view as a strategic base for their external operations.
And finally, to a more positive development, Azerbaijan and Armenia have signed a US-brokered peace agreement during a meeting with US President Donald Trump that would boost bilateral economic ties after decades of conflict. The deal between the South Caucasus rivals, assuming it holds, would be a significant accomplishment for the Trump administration and one that is sure to rattle Moscow, which sees the region as within its sphere of influence, with both countries having formerly been part of the Soviet Union.
Donald Trump also heralding that the two countries have committed to stop fighting, open up diplomatic relations, and respect each other's territorial integrity. The three-way handshake includes exclusive US development rights to a strategic transit corridor through the South Caucasus that the White House says will facilitate greater exports of energy and other resources. It also garnered the 47th president another nomination for his much-coveted award, with Azerbaijan's president asking, who, if not President Trump, deserves the Nobel Peace Prize?
Okay, Ben, as is tradition, something completely different now. I don't know if you've ever considered a career change. Not that you should. You're very good at this one.
Yeah.
But this week, there was a cautionary tale for anyone looking to get into the assassin business.
I think I'd be a good assassin, aside from the fact that I'm very loud and very tall and I would be seen coming pretty easily.
I think you'd do okay. Unlike Amy Betro, though, a childhood development and graphic design graduate from the US city of West Alice, she appears to have agreed to settle a family feud in the UK after meeting someone on an internet dating app. Disguised in a niqab and using a 9mm gun, she tried to shoot the target at point-blank range, but get this, the gun jammed and the guy got away.
Yeah, check your gun before you do a contract killing. Now, police described her as, quote, fairly unexceptional with no criminal footprint, and it remains unclear why she became a would-be assassin, although they added there was no evidence she was actually paid.
Fairly unexceptional. I think that's going to be the title of my book one day. After several years, Betro was eventually traced to a housing complex on the outskirts of Yerevan in Armenia when she was arrested then and extradited to the UK, where she's been found guilty of conspiracy to murder, Ben.
Yeah, I think most people, when they get in the assassin game, think they're going to live the high life, you know, chateaus in France, islands in the Bahamas, not ending up in the housing commission on the outskirts of Yerevan in Armenia.
It is kind of how Killing Eve went, though. I don't know if you watched that one. That made the assassin business look great.
Sign me up. I'm in.
All right. Well, on that note, we should probably end it there. That is The World This Week. Be sure to like and subscribe to the World News Weekly podcast if you're enjoying our content so far. And drop us a comment if there's a global issue you'd like us to do a deep dive on. See you next week, Ben.
Absolutely, Claudia. Wouldn't miss it for the world.